The energy healing experiments, science reveals our natural power to heal. Dr. Gary Schwartz continues with his explanations of what these experiments were intended to do, the results that they gave us, and where, and we'll get to that coming up this hour, where does this lead us? Where, what can we see from where we stand on what healing energy or energy healing experiments like this can do for our future? We'll get into that, but the main part of the show coming up next, the discussion of the latest research into transplants and the characteristics, the things that change about the recipient that may have to do with the energy of the donor coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. The book is The Energy Healing Experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz from the University of Arizona, where he teaches everything except PE. So let's go back to this thing about to the energy at a cellular level of the body. That is, where what is the seat of the soul, if you will, on this? What, from where does the energy emanate? Do we know?
Well, interestingly, if we take into account what quantum physics tells us,
okay,
and then we combine that with what systems theory tells us, we are led to the conclusion that energy operates at every level, from the subatomic particle and even the virtual particles like photons, all the way through complex molecules like DNA, through the whole of the cell itself, through complete organ systems like a heart or a brain, through the body and beyond. And so therefore, it's not like the energy begins at the cellular level or at the DNA level, but actually the energy and information pervades all of it. You know, you've heard of the term, it's turtles all the way down. It's energy all the way down.
Okay.
And therefore, the essence of who we are is almost, if you would, holographic, because it's actually organized at all these different levels. And although it's really hard to sort of comprehend all of this or to make sense of all of this, because it's so outrageously complex, the truth is that's the way it really is.
All right, so let's just say then it's like cloning, that you could take one cell and there's enough imprinted information in one cell of what the whole thing is supposed to look like. The whole blueprint is in that one cell, that you could theoretically replicate the entire based on the partial.
Exactly. In fact, and that the components of the cell will have this too. So although this is very controversial, the whole of the cell is not just simply in the DNA, but it's literally in the structure of the water which comprises the cell, which is 70 to 80% of the cell.
Now, that makes sense for physiology. That makes sense for the amount of hair that will grow on a man's back, or, you know, the color and, you know, direction of their toenails or something.
Right.
But that doesn't always... That doesn't explain what seems to be happening with some of these transplant cases, and I think this is a good way to get into that, because we are talking about energy of a different sort when you take something that had been in one body and you transplant it into another.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no, and let me suggest that you think about this, and that is, we know, for example, that our brains are involved with our emotions and involved with our thoughts. I say involved with our emotions and our thoughts, because I don't want us to come to the conclusion that the brain is creating our thoughts and emotions. In fact, we can talk about this later, but it's more like an antenna receiver for consciousness than it is actually a creator of consciousness. But if we therefore assume that everything that we're even conscious of, all of our personal history, is somehow involved with the energy and information of our anatomy and physiology, including our consciousness, then that energy and information is going to be literally stored also within every cell. And so therefore, we can come to the prediction that that it's not just the, quote, brain that learns, but literally the storage of information and energy is occurring throughout the body. And therefore, an organ like the heart is a very brilliant system for retaining some of the essence of who we are.
Okay. First of all, I made a similar argument once to Matthew Alper, the guy who wrote The God Part of the Brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because I said, well, what if the God part of the brain, he was talking about it as being a transmitter and that, you know, you could accentuate it and you could get a feeling of divine euphoria, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what if it's not that? What if it's a receiver? And some people just don't have it. And some people, you know, they don't have that part of their brain doesn't pick up the vibrations of the divine.
Right. And or it's been turned off for a set of reasons. They have it.
Right.
It's been suppressed.
Yeah, he didn't like that argument.
I bet he didn't. But he also probably wouldn't like our research on life after death either.
He probably wouldn't like that either. All right, but sorry. So, but again, I think this is where it really gets really intriguing, though, because you're talking about, say, let's say the heart transplant. You're going to transplant a heart into somebody.
Right.
Okay, that heart is comprised of cells from the original body, that heart... We think of it as being very, it's muscle tissue,
exactly.
and it's some fat and it's some other things. And we transplant that into another person. And that when it's in the other person, it goes back to its primary function, which was to, you know, process blood, oxygenate blood throughout the body. That's its primary function. We don't think of it as having a software program loaded into it that carries over information from the donor.
That's correct. But that's because we don't really think about it very clearly. In a previous book that I wrote called The Living Energy Universe, I actually describe how the reason why, for example, the brain, quote, learns is because the brain neurons have what are called feedback loops. We call it a neural network. And what's interesting about this is that in order for a network to learn, the output of the network must feed back to the input of the network. And by the way, if you connect the feedback loop from the output to the input, the network will not learn. Now, what's interesting is that we can model that in a computer. That's where artificial intelligence comes in. And we have what's called neural network software. But there are no neurons in the brain. There are just these feedback loops and so on. And again, if you cut those loops, they don't learn. And so here's the big take-home message. Do neurons learn because they're neurons, or do they learn because their architecture is that they're created as a network with feedback loops? And it's a no-brainer, pun intended, meaning that the reason why the computer can learn the same way that the neurons learn is because what does the learning are the feedback loops in a network. Now, all organ systems are actually comprised of feedback networks because that's how systems work. All systems have feedback. Therefore, if feedback is what's actually involved with learning, then the heart's going to learn just like the brain's going to learn. It's not going to learn maybe as, quote, as well because it doesn't have as many feedback loops, but it's still got billions and billions of cells which are orchestrated. And therefore, simple logic takes you to the conclusion is that the heart, which is in the center of the body that's receiving all these electrical and signals streaming through it from all the different organs, is going to integrate and orchestrate a significant subset of the essence of who we are.
Okay, but aren't there differences between the cells that comprise our brain matter and the cells that comprise our heart matter?
They are different, but what they share in common is that they're organized with complex feedback loops. Hmm. And it's the feedback that allows the learning to take place. Now that's the big take-home message.
I imagine a guitar player standing in front of an amp,
yes.
who hits a note, who then the note feeds back on itself, that feeds back on itself, that feeds back on itself, and that one note, that one strum of the guitar, then becomes this sort of ongoing feedback loop, right?
Exactly.
Is that sort of
reverberating circuit? By the way, were you a guitarist?
Not a good one. That would be about my level of performance. If you liked that, I'd be great. But I don't.
Because I was a guitarist. Okay. And I even played professionally for a while. I was not great, but I played, you know, they paid me for some ridiculous reason.
Do you teach music in Arizona, too?
No,
do you do
I
that?
Don't. Okay. But I'm doing research now on music and sound as a healing energy, but that's another story.
Anyway, what I keep thinking, I want to go back to the guitar loop because I think, is that...
You know, I want to stay with the guitar because the take-home message is what goes around and stays around evolves around. And with the guitar or with a microphone, where it works the same way, when you connect that feedback loop, and we call it feedback, there's an echo. The system literally continues to remember that which was originally created.
And is that autism?
Autism? No.
No. Stay with me on that.
Yeah,
is that kind of like autism, where the feedback loop is going on, and that somebody repeats something over and over again, and they just kind of become fixed on something more?
Well, I think autism is could be described as when that system goes out of control.
Right.
But that's a different story from saying that the normal process of learning involves feedback loops. By the way, that's how the brain learns, feedback loops. And feedback exists at every system at every level. So getting back to your main point here, you know, when an organ is transplanted, let's say their heart or heart and lungs, for example, you know, people have to take these immunosuppressant drugs because the body attempts to reject it. Now, here's what medicine typically assumes. They assume that what the body is doing is treating the DNA and of the new cells as foreign to the recipient's DNA, and so it's, quote, rejecting it. But what they don't entertain is the possibility that the body's not simply rejecting the anatomy or the biochemistry, but it's attempting to reject the energy and information that's stored within the cells. And that's why where the psychology of cardiac transplant patients becomes really important, because the prediction would be, therefore, if people could learn to accept and embrace their hearts psychologically and energetically, they might actually be a reduced need for antisuppressant medication, because they're actually then allowing the integration of the energy and information of the heart with the rest of their body.
Is it like having two software programs running simultaneously?
Exactly. It's like two networks. And I talk about cellular network systems within the Energy Healing Experiments book. And it's sort of like, how does Verizon get to talk to Sprint? Well, they have to be coordinated and integrated so that instead of being in competition, they actually can communicate effectively.
Yeah, but I mean, if you had two operating platforms built into onto your hard drive,
right?
And so every time you booted up, your computer was having to choose between which one of the operating platforms. Would that not explain why the push and pull of a heart going into a new body, if it has DNA and cellular memory,
right,
it's trying to also transmit information into the body, not just be a functioning, you know, throbbing muscle.
It's a beautiful metaphor. By the way, it's delightful to talk to somebody who thinks about these issues so deeply. Thank you for that.
Well, and you know what? And thank you for writing a book that allows you to think about stuff like that without having to get stoned. I mean, these are the kind of stuff I would sit around and have conversations with friends in high school. This would be the kind of stuff they'd be talking about, but they were totally high. So this is I almost want to go back in time now and sit there, and I could finally converse with them. I know what the heck they were talking about.
You know what's really interesting, by the way? This book provides scientific validation for a lot of things that we could get stoned about. And it's nice to be able, and it's a privilege to be able to do research that actually reveals that there's a reality to all of this, and we shouldn't be throwing stones. We should be celebrating what the universe is revealing to us.
Well, and so that brings us to this idea somehow that the person, the recipient, could be changed by the personality traits or the characteristics or some of the other more ethereal aspects of the donor information that's in the heart.
Absolutely. And what's interesting also, you know, you talked about your idea about how if the brain is a receiver, then receiver of information, then if part of the receiver is missing or is just turned off or the volume is turned down, it's not going to pick up the signal. One of the things that people often ask me about when we talk about the heart transplant research that I was involved with, how is it that only a small percentage of patients actually report personality changes that end up matching those of the donor? And I explained to people that a lot of people, their brains are literally turned off. They're literally repressing. They're shutting down awareness out of fear, out of lack of understanding, also some of the drugs they take. And so consequently, many people are not actually going to allow those signals to reach their consciousness.
Now, so let's go into how can you do an experiment that would show that the recipient of a transplant had changed their characteristics, their distinct personality patterns, to be more accommodating to the donor?
Okay. Well, first of all, we have to define that these experiments are being done, quote, as a side effect of transplant surgery. It's not like we're doing an experiment where we're taking dogs' hearts, you know, one set of dogs that, let's say, were trained to be loving and another set of dogs that were trained to be fighters, and then transplanting the dog's heart into donor hearts. and looking to see whether the personality of the dogs changed. And by the way, that could be done. No one's done that study yet.
Well, that could end up being the defense for Michael Vick before it's over. So
right.
You're doing some sort of scientific experiments, but so
well,
they've tried everything else so far.
Books here, but getting back to and the implications. But getting back to your question, what happens is that the in order to do research in this area, what you need to do is you need to be able to track patients who have had transplants, where after their transplants, they've discovered changes in their personality which are bizarre to them because they're unexpected to them, and then independently verify that the characteristics of the donor actually predate and predict the personality changes that take place in the recipient. And by the way, there have been, to the best of my knowledge, no, quote, formal experiments that have done this. Instead, what's happened is that people have collected systematically a series of case studies which document that this effect occurs. And the challenge has been actually to raise the research money to be able to do a formal experiment of this. But I had the privilege of working with Paul Pearsall, who wrote a book called The Heart's Code, and we published 10 cases of cardiac transplants, where not only was the personality change of the donor able to be verified, but there were at least two members of the donor's family that could actually verify that the donor personality matched that of the patient. So you had verification on both sides. And some of these stories are just, they're very dramatic and they're very heart-wrenching.
Give us an example of that.
Sure. I'll give you two of my favorites. In one case, there was a man who worked in a factory who needed a heart transplant, and he received the transplant of a young black man. And he was, he had the standard stereotypes of, for example, African Americans tend to like rap music. And he didn't want to start wanting to like rap music. It's very amusing. But what happened was he developed a passion for classical music. I mean, he started paying attention to classical music. He started singing melodies of classical music. It drove his wife a little crazy. She couldn't understand it. They later ended up meeting the mother of the young man who was killed. And they discovered that this young man had just left his violin lessons. He was a classical violinist. And he was struck by a car and killed. And so here was a case where a man had a personality change that was directly related to a fundamental preference of the heart of the young man that he had within him, and where it was a completely different from what his, quote, fears were. That's one case. A second case, and this is just very precious, was reported to Paul Pearsall by a psychiatrist, and I suspect that this is a credible account. There was this young child, a girl, who received a heart of a girl who had been murdered.
All right. I'm going to, because the story, the way it's going, I just don't want to rush you through it, so I'm going to ask you to hold on that.
Sure.
We'll just do it coming up just a minute. We'll pick it up right there. A girl who receives the heart of another girl who had been murdered. And when we go to the phones coming up next hour, let's go ahead and put that on the table then, Dr. Schwartz. We'll just say, if you've ever been the recipient of a transplant, have you noted, what did you notice about the way you changed afterward? And I'd be curious, because you just changed just because you got a second lease on life,
mm-hmm.
because you feel a sense of gratitude, ebullience that you have achieved, another milestone that you never thought you'd ever have. I don't know. We'll come back to that. And we'll get the rest of the comments, too, coming up for Dr. Gary Schwartz with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Gary Schwartz, Dr. Gary Schwartz. The Energy Healing Experiments is the book, and it's just fascinating. We'll get back to that story about the donor, a girl, whose personality changed after receiving the heart from another girl, and we'll get into some of the other stories that are in the book. It's amazing work. he's been doing. And then I'll also just remind you, too, if you hook up to it at coasttocoastam.com, you can find out more about my blog for tonight. And thank you, the people who have emailed in already on that. It's just some crypto news from earlier in the night, but you can find that, my IP Freely blog, at coasttocoastam.com. Your calls coming up after the top of the hour, and we'll be looking for people who have had a transplant to see whether or not you noticed anything change about you that you can't account for. Could it have been something about the donor? Maybe you knew the donor. Maybe you found out about the donor later on. We'll use that anecdotally as the conversation continues on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Dr. Gary Schwartz was just getting into story number two, an example of a girl that had undergone a personality shift after receiving an organ from another girl that had been murdered. Dr. Schwartz, if you could just pick that up, that'd be great.
Yes, this little girl received the heart of another girl who had been murdered, and she began having nightmares. And in her dreams, she was actually seeing details of a little girl being murdered. And her mother was very upset. Her mother didn't know whether or not her daughter was going crazy, whether this was a side effect of the medication, whether there was something with the transplant, could she have possibly been connecting with the little girl who died. Anyway, she brought her daughter to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist evaluated this little girl, child psychiatrist, and came to the conclusion that this girl didn't seem crazy. She seemed to be having information, and some of this information was verifiable by the police. So she then took the daughter and the mother to the police, and it turned out that details of the daughter's dream not only matched what the police knew, but more importantly, there were other details that allowed them to then ultimately arrest and bring to justice the person who had murdered the little girl who died.
That sounds like such an urban legend.
I know it sounds like an urban legend. And normally, you know, we would dismiss such a thing out of hand. However, when first of all, there's scientific reasoning that would predict that such a thing should be able to happen in the first place. And secondly, the account is being given by a credible psychiatrist. These are quote extraordinary accounts. To the extent that they can be verified scientifically, we need to listen to them.
Well, I'm good with that, but I mean, you'll pardon me for a cheap analogy here, but there's scientific reasoning that says the 35W bridge should still be up.
Yes, just because there's reasoning doesn't mean that it's correct.
Right.
So what's the bottom line? The bottom line is the proof is in the pudding. That's why it's called the energy healing experiments. You know, there are all kinds of, quote, theories, but the theories ultimately don't matter. What matters is what turns out to be true, i.e. what can be demonstrated under controlled conditions. And that's where the formal experiments in this book become so important, because it allows us to determine which of our, you know, our stories, our beliefs are true, and which of them are not.
And so let's continue to pursue this a little bit. And to its, where do we go with its logical end? When we're talking about donors, should we then be thinking about the compatibility of a donor at a much more at a psychological level as well as a physiological one, or it's not just a matter of blood type and the size of the heart and the chest cavity, et cetera, but what kind of life one person led, the donor led, before we would allow them to have that heart, you know, implanted into another person's body?
In theory, although it's very, you know, painful and complicated, the ethical question is, of course. I mean, if it turns out that there are, pathology or problems in the life of the potential donor, the recipient should at least be aware of that possibility and then be able to make a choice. Of course, in heart transplants, this is also extraordinarily difficult because things have to be done in a very quick time frame.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that in principle, we need to entertain this, and it should be part of informed consent. It's the same thing if we discover, for example, that the emotional state of a healer, that his or her energy is, you know, going to potentially affect our cellular health and well-being. Or
right.
Imagine, for example, that all of this is true, and that then the science is supporting this. And I mean science as in experiments are supporting this. And now you talk about hospitals, which, as you know, you've got very stressed doctors and very stressed workers working under long hours and so on. They're working under conditions where they're no longer feeling either supported or that they're able to do their jobs the way they feel they should be done properly because of the HMOs and having to do things in a very quick time frame.
Right.
You've also got environments of hospitals which are electromagnetically polluted. So you not only got the energy of the medical staff and the nursing staff as being stressed, but you've also got all these, unfriendly environmental conditions. That makes a hospital potentially a dangerous place to be in from an energetic point of view. And we have to entertain these possibilities and address them, even though they may be difficult or economically challenging or ethically, require that we make adjustments.
There's a small hospital outside of the Twin Cities that puts a big emphasis on the feng shui layout of every room, every hallway, that they have all sorts of healing art and sculpture that's done in the hallways, and that everything that is put in a room has to be passed through a board of art, I guess, judges of some sort, mm-hmm. who look at everything for their healing potential, and whether the image is, encourages enough in the way of a spiritual or physical, I guess, maybe even regrowth. But then they also have other things like a labyrinth in the garden, and every room faces rose bushes or flowers, and every room's on the first floor. They don't have any second story rooms. I mean, it's very interesting how they went to all of this trouble to try to be on the cutting edge of this type of healing medicine.
Yes, and also by creating such an environment for their patients, they're also creating such an environment for their staff. What kind of environment would you feel more comfortable working in? One that's beautiful, where there's healing music, where there's healing art, where you yourself want to go to work because it's so comforting? Or would you prefer to be in an environment where the colors clash and and there's all this noise and so on and so forth? I mean, it's sort of obvious that it's that for many, many reasons, this is a wise thing to do.
Or industrial gray-green tile and all that other stuff. But I'll go back to the heart thing and the idea of somebody that's up to be a donor. Should we tell the potential recipient of this heart transplant, look, just want to let you know this was not a person who lived a good life. They have a very healthy heart, but that's mostly because they were very selfish. They didn't care about anybody else but themselves, which was good because it means they walked several miles a day or whatever, and they were known by their friends as being black-hearted. They didn't give to charity. There was nobody there at their funeral. However we describe that, and leave that up to the recipient to decide whether or not that's the kind of heart that he wants in him or her.
Well, again, in the abstract, we could say yes. In the concrete, of course, the average patient who's waiting for a heart may or may not be in either psychological or physiological state to even process that information. So then you'd have to say, well, that decision should also be potentially made by the family.
Right.
And if you have a choice between, living or dying, or taking the heart of someone whose life you don't necessarily admire, you still might obviously choose to take the risk in order to be able to continue physically on the planet. These are very difficult, ethical questions, but they are real, and they need to be considered. Now, of course, being a scientist, what I have to say is that the stories that we've collected, even albeit as controlled as they are, they really need to be replicated under large, controlled experiments in order to be able to draw any firm conclusions. And the challenge is for science to be able to address these questions, even though they're controversial, and even though the implications, would require that we change the way we do things and the way we think about things. But
ten
that's
years,
part of the excitement of science.
10 years after somebody has had a transplant, if you went back in with a scalpel and took off part of their transplanted heart, for example, the heart that had been implanted into them, if you took that sample from the donor heart, would it still have the donor heart's DNA
Well, we certainly have the donor's heart DNA if you do the heart pick out. The question is, how much of the heart would now have incorporated the information of the recipient? And by the way, how much of the recipient's DNA information would now be, the donor's information would now be observed by the recipient? So if you can imagine taking the donor's heart out now,
right,
and replacing it with somebody else's heart, would the personality changes persist?
Right.
And I think that part depends upon how long the heart has been in the brain and in the body and in total, and also how, to what extent that information has been, you know, if you would digest it and integrate it into the total memory system of the, you know, of the recipient. You know, it's interesting, Ian, you actually brought up the question about even life after death, the whole idea of,
right,
that our consciousness continues after we physically die, and how does that relate to the energy healing experiments? And I was curious, why is it that did you bring up that particular topic?
Well, I've always been interested in it, and I have it when I was reading particularly the section in your book in which you offered your reflections on some people like John Edwards, and I have had some contact both through this show and through others with those that profess to be able to speak for the dead.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself in the position of wanting to believe them, but actually in my own personal experience, being disconfirmed that they're able to do anything from just things that some of the most famous of them have said to me, things they've said to me, which were totally 100% wrong, and they were claiming that they were able to do this in some sort of verifiable, observable manner.
Right. Well, let's stress two aspects of this. First of all, you could say, well, why did I include such work in the Energy Healing Experiments book?
Right.
And part of the reason was because we had actually included questions about people's experience of life after death as an evaluation of individual differences in people's both sensitivity to detecting the energy of others and also in actually recovery from heart disease. And I was initially shocked to find that if people, for example, reported having experienced a communication from someone who had died, what's called an after-death communication, which they had personally experienced, and of course we don't know whether that was, quote, a real experience or an imagined one, but if they reported having it, not only were they more accurate in being able to detect the energy and intention in a controlled experiment, but they were also more likely to recover more effectively from heart surgery. And and that becomes extraordinarily interesting because it suggests that there may be not only some reality to the after-death communications if it relates to energy detection, but also that it may actually have some health consequences. And by the way, healers often report that part of what they do is that they receive, quote, intuition or guidance from a larger spiritual reality, so that the healing is not just their own personal energy, but they, quote, they're receiving, quote, assistance from above.
But I think there's a difference between intuition and guidance from above. And I'm good with the guidance from above in another context. I don't want to confuse the two.
Right.
Because when people say from above, I'm not looking for angel guides who are going to come in and they're standing on my shoulders and whatever, and they're going to tell this person something. To me, there's something really cool about intuition. And I think I'm more intuitive than some people I know, and I know,
right,
that there are other people considerably more intuitive than I am, but still, intuition, it seems to me, to be, have its own kind of gestalt.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. The question is, I'm just recounting what healers claim.
Right.
Healers claim that part of the source of their intuition is coming from, for example, people who have died.
Right.
Now, that's their claim. I'm not saying whether their claim is true or not. I'm saying that's what they claim. And what happens if science could actually address that question? And if you'd like, we could have another whole show on this. We could talk about,
right,
research about how do you address,
I'd love that,
whether or not certain mediums are real or not.
Yeah, I'd love that.
How do you,
well,
bring that into the laboratory?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and for that matter, too, how many of them are unwilling to go into a laboratory because I think they suspect that there are more limitations than,
exactly,
are in their press release. I mean, I will tell you, just for the sake of argument, I sat with one of the best known mediums on the planet, and if I didn't give him anything.
Good.
He wanted to. He was fishing for it. I'm getting a name. Begins with A. Alvin. It was such a carny act to me. And I wanted to think that he could just, if there was a mechanism by which he could do that, then he could just look at me and he could say, by the way, your dad says, and he could say something that would be phenomenal.
Right.
But instead, he was, if I hadn't said anything, he had nothing to work with.
Well, first of all, you know, for some mediums, they're really lousy.
Right.
And they do fish. And they engage in what's called cold reading. Okay?
Right.
However, we've done experiments where the medium never sees the sitter, never hears from the sitter.
That's fascinating.
Has no communication with the sitter.
That's fascinating.
And even where the experimenter doesn't know details about the sitter or the deceased, what's called a proxy sitter. So that rules out all of this kind of fishing expedition and any kind of searching or getting feedback. And the really, quote, superstars, I call them Michael Jordan of the mediumship world, they end up being able to still get accurate information, way above chance, which you can't explain by any of these conventional mechanisms. Now, I want to just briefly mention about the Michael Jordan phenomena, because you know what Michael Jordan's average percentage of getting his shots in from the floor were?
Probably 33%.
I think it was closer to 45 or 48,
okay.
but it was still less than 50%, okay?
Right. Even the best shooters have lower percentages than you think.
Right.
Right.
And also, they typically have air balls.
Right.
And they also make fouls. And some days they have terrible days. But we don't, therefore, because Michael Jordan fouls or because he has air balls or because he has an off game, therefore come to the conclusion that Michael Jordan's a fraud or he can't play basketball. So what we have to do is to be very careful to not overgeneralize from a few bad shots or a few fouls or an off day and therefore draw a conclusion that this is impossible or unreal. What you have to do is you have to collect a lot of data under controlled conditions and then see what the real statistics are.
Well, okay, I'll go with you on this, but here's the difference to me, to extend your metaphor about mediums and Michael Jordan a little bit further. Michael Jordan didn't build a reputation on other people taking his shots for him. And I think that's the difference, is that that's where too often these mediums rely on other people to give them the information, which then they take credit for.
Absolutely.
And,
okay.
And that's the part that really, and you can see it in these TV shows, and I know these guys are super popular, but it clearly, you know, when they throw out a question going, I'm getting a message from a Betty. Does somebody, does the name Betty mean anything? And somebody stands up and says, I know a Betty. And it's like, okay, well, you just took the shot for him from half court.
Yeah,
and he's
way,
standing there parading around like he got something.
Yeah, when I started doing research in this area, I actually took courses in how to be a fake medium. So I know what the tricks are.
Okay.
And I also know how to distinguish the fakes from the real ones.
Well, that is another conversation that I would love to have with
Let's
you.
Let's have it someday.
Okay, very good. Gary Schwartz, Dr. Gary Schwartz's book, The Energy Healing Experiments. All right, coming up then, we'll give you all the numbers so that you can join the conversation too. We'll be looking for people who are donor recipients and whether or not you've made any changes. Anything you could feel was something that you didn't have any control over. You just did become different after you got your transplant. And we'll talk a little bit about the future of the energy healing experiments as well. Where is this taking us? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.